All right. Esther, chapter 8. That's where we are. And this really is the close of the book, the last section of the book. So we'll be basically wrapping this up tonight. I don't know that we'll cover every verse in chapters 8 and 9. Of course, 10, you know, by now only has three verses. And so basically, the book has the main theme of the book, everything that we're looking forward to happening. If you've studied it before and know anything about the book of Esther, has pretty much been wrapped up. The great enemy of the Jews has been put to death. Haman has gotten what he deserves, as someone said. And certainly, as you read and study, that's the dramatic part of the book. And yet, even though that has happened, there is still one issue that has to be resolved. You still have this decree out there that says that the Jews are going to be exterminated, and so that hasn't yet been handled. And so as we open up in chapter 8, we find that the Esther is very much aware of that, and it's bothering her. And so we'll pick up there in chapter 8. In the beginning there, I think we covered the first couple of verses last week. On that day, King Ahasuerus gave to Queen Esther the house of Haman, the enemy of the Jews, and Mordecai came before the king, for Esther had told what he was to her. And so we found last week that he has been elevated. So basically, the king gives him fame. And then if we kept reading there, you'll recall that Esther, the king gave her the house of Haman, and she then in turn gave it to Mordecai. So the king gave him fame, and Esther gave him fortune. And now Mordecai is sitting pretty. And so this is one of the most amazing reversals that you're ever going to see in anyone's life, in the life of two people. In the life of Haman, of course, you know, he had all of those riches and everything. But it's really a reminder of people just having their priorities in the wrong place and emphasizing the wrong things in life. He wanted power and possession, popularity even. We know how much that meant to him. He was prideful. All of those things that really aren't any good and that lead to disaster in someone's life. And it sort of reminds us of what Jesus said in the Sermon on the Mount. Jesus, of course, was talking about material things. And that was, without a question, a problem that Mordecai had. But Jesus in Matthew 6 at verse 19 said, "Do not lay up for yourselves treasures on earth where moth and rust destroy and where thieves break in and steal, but lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven where neither moth nor rust destroys and where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also." And of course, a great teaching by our Lord. And while Haman did have a problem with material things, his problems, as I just said, went beyond that. Pride, he was egotistical, he was petty, all of those things. But just his mind and focus was on all the wrong things. And when you do that, when you have that kind of character, and when you are materialistic and worried about popularity, all that stuff goes away. Like, you can be popular one day and then the next day or the next week or the next month be unpopular. It's just the way it goes. You can have all kind of possessions one day and literally the next day be broke. It's the way that goes. And so we want to make sure our heart is in the right place, and that we are treasuring the kind of things, the spiritual riches that we have in Christ, that those are the things that we should focus on. So Haman, of course, his life was just a mess. And so we see a great fall with regard to him. And what a reversal, and a great reversal on the part of Mordecai as well. Now, all of a sudden, he has what Haman used to have, including his house and his possessions. And remember, that would involve everything that goes along with his estate. And we know that he was a very wealthy man. And so now Mordecai is a very wealthy man. And he has that along with the power that Haman so desperately craved. Now it all goes to Haman. Still, there's a problem. So at verse 3, it says, and then Esther spoke again to the king. She says she fell at his feet and wept and pleaded with him to avert the evil plan Haman the Agagite and the plot that he had devised against the Jews. And so again we see the character of Esther throughout this, and particularly in this text. We're kind of wrapping this up. And so what have we found about Esther? She certainly is a woman of great faith. We know that. But she's humble, has a submissive heart, a meek and quiet spirit. All of those things that certainly you sisters in Christ should want to imitate. And all of us as Christians, there's a lot about her character that we should all want to imitate. But it's just interesting, even now, as she approaches Xerxes, that she does so in a very, very humble way. And let's not forget, I mean, she's not only the queen. I think we could probably predict she'd still be pretty respectful towards the king. But it is still a lesson for all you wives and the attitude and the character you have with regard to your husbands. I mean, we don't know about their relationship very much. We know that he has affection for her, and so that he is impressed, of course, with her beauty. Let's not forget, she's one of the most beautiful women in the world, and so we know that. But what her relationship was towards him, there's not a whole lot said about that. He could not have been the easiest man to be married to. There's no doubt about that. But in every case, she's very respectful. She's very humble. Here, she falls at his feet. And so that there's wisdom in that kind of humility. And we know what the Bible teaches. All of us ought to be humble and respectful towards people. But you remember what Peter said about that, and this would apply to Esther in 1 Peter chapter 5. It would almost seem he could have been writing about her in this. In 1 Peter chapter 5 at verse, I believe it is 8, or verse 6, I'm sorry, 1 Peter 5 and at verse 6. Listen at this. Peter writes, humble yourself, therefore, under the mighty hand of God, so that at the proper time he may exalt you. Has that happened to Esther? She's been exalted, hasn't she? She humbled herself. And now she's the queen married to the most powerful man on earth. She has been exalted. And yet in that exalted state, she continues to do a couple of things. As I've been saying, she continues to show respect. Notice this language that she uses. Not only did she bow at his feet, but it goes on to say that at verse 4, when the king held out the golden scepter to Esther, which seems to imply, it's not stated specifically, but it would seem to imply that she has once again gone into his presence without the proper authority to do so. She just, did. And so, but again, it's because the stake of her, the fate of her people is at stake. So she does that again, and he immediately, we know by now the affection he has. She probably knew it wasn't quite as dangerous as the first time. Remember the first time they hadn't talked in 30 days. And now things are a little bit different. Still, You mean this is a man with a temperament that is unpredictable. So it was a risk, but he immediately holds out the golden scepter, and so then it says that she said, and if it please the king, she rises to her feet and said, if it pleases the king, and if I found favor in his sight, and if the thing seems right before the king, I am pleasing in his eyes, let an order be written to revoke the letters devised by Haman, the Agagite, the son of Hammedatha, which he wrote to destroy the Jews. And so you see that kind of language there. Again, it's wise. She's smart. She's addressing him the right way. But, you know, that takes some humility to do that. But the main thing in this text that should be impressive to us is as you go on to read that, listen at what she says next. She says, for how can I bear to see the calamity that is coming to my people? Or how can I bear to see the destruction of my kindred? What does that kind of language tell you? What's implied by that? Do you see anything? Huh? Yeah, right. Yeah, I mean, there's that. That's the main thing. She really loves her people. And so there's another great characteristic. She is a kind, compassionate woman, along with everything else. And she does love her people. She loves people. And she's kind to people. But right now, you can tell, and this should be common sense to us, Esther is safe. Like what Haman said, what Mordecai said in the very beginning wasn't exactly accurate. Like, there is no, do you think there's any way in the world, if this decree goes forward and the Jews are exterminated, do you think for a minute Esther would be one of them? I tell you right now, Xerxes is not letting a thing happen to Esther. That's not happening. And it's even, I would even argue that Mordecai is safe. Like, he's the second in command of all of Persia now. He's not going to be involved in that extermination if that were to go forward. And the language here, you can tell that she knows that. Why would she use that kind of language? If that wasn't the case, how can I bear to see the calamity that is coming to my people? Well, if she was one of them, she wouldn't be seeing anything. She'd be being executed as well. She is saying, how can I watch all of that? And you know, I couldn't live with that. And so she's safe. And so the point of it all, and it points to this love that she has for people, but the point of it is, here she is, risking her life again, even if it's not quite to the same extent, risking her life again, going before the king uninvited for other people. She's not doing it for herself. She's good. She's safe. It's for other people. She intercedes because indeed she loves her people to the point where she falls down and weeps. It is not something fake. It's not phony. She really is disturbed about what's going to happen to her people. And even though she has a nice, comfortable life in the palace, and she'd be okay. And a lot of people have pointed out this idea of making intercession for other people and praying for other people is a great lesson and example for all of us. Because there's people, she was worried about people being destroyed, of course, her kindred, the Jews. But we live in a world where people are going to be destroyed. Maybe not physically, but spirit, but of course in a devil's hell after a while. How often do you intercede for the world around you? How often do you pray for the lost here in Akron or all over the world? Do we intercede like we should? Do we care? Do we weep ever for the lost condition of the majority of people all around us? Do we ever think about that? Or do we even just have, even beyond the spiritual aspect of it? Do you pray for the well-being of people? Do you pray for the government and for the leaders? Or just the people in the world? Like, we're surrounded by people that are struggling. There are people who are homeless. There are people who are abused. There are people who are unemployed. The list goes on. There are people whose life isn't as comfortable and cozy as some of our lives. You ever pray for them? You ever think about praying for them? Do you ever make intercession on behalf of other people? It takes a care of people. Remember the sermon Sunday, the Good Samaritan? Do we have a sympathetic heart? And clearly Esther did. Along with her beauty, along with her wisdom, we've seen that she's clever. We see she's compassionate now, along with humble and obedient, all of those things she had. But what about us? We should try to apply some of those things to our own lives. Well, so she is pleading again on behalf of her people, and she makes a great argument here, but Xerxes, he's basically lets them know, he now speaks to her and to Mordecai, that he's already done what he can. So it says, the king Ahasuerus says to Queen Esther and to Mordecai the Jew, behold, I have given Esther the house of Haman. And they have hanged him on the gallows because he intended to lay hands on the Jews. But you may write as you please with regard to the Jews in the name of the king and seal it with the king's ring. For an edict written in the name of the king and sealed with the king's ring cannot be revoked. And so he can't do anything directly, but it does do something that will greatly help the situation, if not completely solve the situation. He puts it in the hands of Mordecai and says, now you can write a second, an alternative decree, and you do whatever you want with that. And so that is really untying the hands of the Jews. As we go ahead and look at what's involved in that, it says the king's scribes were summoned at the time in the third month, which is the month of Sivan, on the 23rd day. And an edict was written according to all that Mordecai commanded concerning the Jews, to the satraps and the governors and the officials of the provinces from India to Ethiopia, 127 provinces, to each province in his own script and to each people in his own language, and also to the Jews in their script, in their language. That didn't happen the first time. And he wrote in the name of King Ahasuerus and sealed it with the king's signet ring. And then he sent the letters by a mountain carrier, about mounted carriers riding on swift horses that were used in the king's service, bred from the royal stud, saying that the king allowed the Jews. Now, here's the important part. The king allowed the Jews who were in every city to gather and defend their lives, to destroy, to kill, and to annihilate any armed force of any people or province that might attack them, children and women included, to plunder their goods. Now, that untied their hands right there. It maybe wouldn't be the best solution to the situation. I think Esther wanted the king simply to change the original edict, just reverse it. But he tells them, can't do that. It's contrary to the laws of the Medes and the Persians, so I can't do that. Now, I've been telling you, and I firmly believe that if he really, really wanted to, he could have. But that would have been caused more trouble than it was worth. He wanted to come up with a different way, and he did. Mordecai, you sent out a second decree, and whatever, you do what you want. And what he commanded is that the Jews now are able to defend themselves. And that made all the difference in the world. Before, they're a foreign people. And when the king sets out an edict, you can't. They could arm themselves and gather themselves together. That would be contrary to the law itself. Like when you're a kingdom and you have the arrangement that Persia did, conquering kingdoms did things differently. They allowed the people that they took captive basically to live their lives and be spread up, you know, throughout the kingdom, as we have seen, 127 provinces. But there were restrictions on those people. And you certainly couldn't, you know, gang up. And I mean, you had to be very careful, unless one of these foreigners on your land who you have captive revolt and you know, try to a coup or something. But now for one day, it's going to be extended a day, but for one day, the Jews are able to gather themselves together to defend themselves, whatever that may, arm themselves, whatever, and fight against anyone who attacks them. And not only that, Mordecai has become a very powerful man. We don't know how, you know, exactly how much time has passed in all of this, but notice at verse 15, it says, and then Mordecai went out from the presence of the king in the royal robes of blue and white, with a golden crown and a robe of fine linen and purple, and the city of Susa shouted and rejoiced. And that would mostly be the Jews, but it's clear that it involves others. What a contrast here, if you remember back, that when Haman was, you know, put forth the decree to exterminate the Jews, how did the city of Susa, how did they respond then? What, you remember what it said? What was it? Right, they were perplexed. Like, what is going on? Where did this come from? And so they were perplexed, and they didn't like it, clearly. Like, they couldn't understand such a cruel thing to happen. Here, now, they rejoice. They're clearly on the side of the Jews. And we see that, and now some of it is fear. Look at verse 17. Verse 16 says, the Jews had light and gladness, joy, and honor, it says. And in every province and in every city, wherever the king's command and his edict reached, there was gladness and joy among the Jews, a feast and a holiday, and many from the peoples of the country declared themselves Jews, for the fear of the Jews had fallen on them. So many of these individuals became proselytes. And all of this was because of Mordecai. I think I skipped in there somewhere. I don't know exactly what verse it is. It will come in the next chapter. It'll come in chapter 9. But what we're going to find is that the government is behind the Jews. You think that's a little thing? That's pretty important, isn't it? It's now we're going to find it's not just the Jews being able to defend themselves, which gives them a great chance. And let's not forget, they're the people of God. So you think God is on their side? That might help just a little bit. But they have God on their side. And now they know, of course, Esther is a Jew. And so clearly Xerxes is behind them. And Mordecai has become so powerful. He's grown more and more in power and respect that the rest of the people in high places fear him. He's second in command. So they're going to get behind the Jews too. And so now it is almost guaranteed that they're going to prevail and survive this, and that their enemies are going to fall. So as we get into chapter 9, that's really what chapter 9 is all about. It's just showing the enemies of the Jews being destroyed. It says, now in the 12th month, which is the month of Adar, on the 13th day of the same, when the king's command and the edict were about to be carried out, on the very day when the enemies of the Jews hoped to gain the mastery over them, the reverse occurred. The Jews gained mastery over those who hated them. The Jews gathered in the cities throughout all the province of King Ahasuerus to lay hands on those who sought their harm. And no one could stand against them, for the fear of them had fallen on all the peoples. All the officials of the provinces and the satraps and the governors and the royal agents also helped the Jews, for the fear of Mordecai had fallen on them. For Mordecai was great in the king's house, and his fame spread throughout all the provinces, for the man Mordecai grew more and more in power. The Jews struck all their enemies with the sword, killing and destroying them, and did as they pleased to those who hated them. And so they really had complete victory. We're not told all the numbers exactly. We are with regard to the ones who attacked the Jews. It's sort of interesting. This is what the Jews had to deal with. Like, who, after that second decree went out, would actually attack the Jews? And I didn't deal with the timing of all of this, but there were several months. There were close to 9 months between the second decree and the day finally arrived for the people to attack, which means the Jews had a long time to organize and band together and get prepared for this. But it also meant that their enemies did too. But they still didn't have a chance. But what we find is, if you go and read all the verses there, that in Susa, at the beginning, they killed 500 of their enemies. And in all of the cities, the providences beside that, there were 75,000 who were slain. Now, that's kind of interesting, because that tells you all of those people hated the Jews. Like, they gained favor with a lot of people. A lot of people feared them, but that's how many enemies the Jews still had. Can you imagine what would have happened if that second decree didn't go out and they couldn't arm themselves? They'd have been wiped out, right? And that was the original plan, of course, of Haman. They wouldn't have stood a chance. But now the way it turns out, they were able to do those things, and even the government was behind them, and they pretty easily defeated their foes. And so the salvation of the Jews then was finally realized in all of that. And so the rest of chapter 9, we read of some of these. You go down to verse 20, and it says, my caption has the Feast of Purim inaugurated. And so we refer to that feast from time to time. It wasn't an official feast of the Jews. It wasn't established by divine authority. It was basically established by Mordecai and Esther. But it has been practiced, continued to be practiced throughout their generations, even until today. And so it was simply a celebration and a memorial of the great deliverance that the Jews experienced. And we read about that a little bit here. It says, and Mordecai recorded these things, verse 20, and sent letters to all the Jews who were in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus, both near and far, obligating them to keep the 14th day of the month, the Adar, and also the 15th day of the same year by year. And if we were reading this verse by verse, you go back a little bit there, what you discover is that the fighting went on different days in the city and in all the provinces. They ended up having to fight for 2 days in the city. And so the all the other provinces, I think it was the 13th day they fought. And then the 14th day in the city of Susa, they fought. And then Esther was given the permission to extend it another day to make sure that all the enemies of the Jews were thoroughly defeated. And that's what happened. And so when do you have this feast to celebrate their victory? You do it I said that wrong. In the city, it was the 14th day they fought on. And so you're on the 14th or the 15th day. So they just had, let's make it both. So the celebration was both those days, that's the Feast of Purim that they continue to celebrate today. And so it's very important to the Jews because they, you know, they really thought they, until all this happened, it looked like they weren't going to have a chance. They were going to be exterminated. And the providence of God kicked in and all of these things happened that you never could predict. Like, you know, a Jew becoming queen and a Jew becoming second in command in all of the king and all of that, all the providence of God. And it all worked out. And so they're delivered. They were delivered and they celebrate that. And Esther and Mordecai made it so that it would be a permanent thing. I have written in my Bible here, this is what it would be pronounced. I think in the very beginning of all of this, remember we were talking about how that the Jews today in their synagogue, that they'll read the book of Esther. And whenever they come to the name Haman, they just get out of control. And they stomp their feet. They blow horns and they shout and just all kind of things. And then they do that every time the word Haman, the name Haman, is uttered throughout the book of Esther. And that's how they do that even today during the feast. That's a traditional thing for them to do in their synagogues. And well, another thing, at the end of this feast, they have this at the very end of the feast. They read this: "Blessed art thou, O Lord, our God, King of the universe, who has contended our contest, judged our cause, and avenged our wrongs, requited all of the enemies of the souls, and has delivered us from our oppressors. Blessed art thou, who has delivered thy people from their oppressors. Thou art the Lord of salvation." Now, the only reason I read that is that that's important. What have we said about the book of Esther about God? He's not ever mentioned. But do the Jews think God was involved in their deliverance? Absolutely. His name isn't mentioned in the book of Esther, but God is all throughout the book. In fact, before the bell rings, as we just wrap up Esther, we think about what can we learn from the book of Esther. And really, the overall message of Esther is a wonderful one for all of us, and it has to do with the sovereignty of God. It has to do with God being in control. As I said a few moments ago, you couldn't see any of this developing the way it did. But God's in control. Even when it looks like things are against us, the forces are fighting against us, the forces of the world doesn't look like we have a chance, don't ever think, no matter how your life is going, don't ever think, well, you know, God, he's kind of disappeared. He's off on vacation or he doesn't know. Every problem you ever have, God is aware of it. And he's in control. He's on his throne. Do you think Mordecai, when he first put that sackcloth on and he was mourning and cried out loud in the king's gate, he'd ever imagine that the way this thing was going to turn out was with him in second in command in this powerful kingdom? Now, we do know he believed that everything was going to work out because he had faith in God, but he couldn't predict that. But God has a way. I mean, you just think of it. It puts you in mind of Romans when Paul said, all things work together for them that love God. And what was Paul talking about specifically there? Suffering. That's really what he was dealing with. And here's the biggest threat a nation could ever have. They're about to be exterminated, completely wiped out. But all things work together when God's in control. Do you think there's a reason for us not to believe that today? Like, should we just think, yeah, but God really cared about them, but we're not. Do you think God cares about us? Do you think God cares about you? That's the thing that you ought to stop. And I mean, all of us, we need to realize, not even just as a church, but as individual, God cares about Don Wright. He cares about what's going on in my life. And the providence of God, the second thing that we cannot miss from the book of Esther, is that God's providence is real. Not only is he in control, but sometimes, even when we don't know exactly when or how, he does intervene in our lives. Raise your hand if you think the providence of God is no longer a thing. Anybody here think that God doesn't work providentially anymore? I won't ask you to raise your hand, but how many of you believe that there are times that you know of, that you really believe in your heart, that God has providentially worked in your lives? I imagine that most of you would raise your hand. This powerful God who is sovereign and in control, he still is with us and intervenes sometimes. Not miraculously, but providentially. And if you don't learn that from, if we can't get that from the book of Esther, there isn't anything to get from it. And another, I'll tell you another thing we learned, and that Haman learned, that if you fight against the people of God, in the end, you're going to have to pay a price for that. There's a passage. Turn over to Isaiah chapter 54 and at verse 17. Isaiah chapter 54 at verse 17. Listen at this. Isaiah 54, verse 17. I don't like the way that sounds. No weapon that is fashioned against you. Okay, yeah. No weapon that is fashioned against you. If you back up, he's talking about his servants. God is talking about his servants, those who serve him. No weapons that is fashioned against you shall succeed, and you shall refute every tongue that rises against you in judgment. This is the heritage of the servants of the Lord, and their vindication from me, declares the Lord. And the point of that is simply, you just have to trust. Things in life aren't always fair. We have enemies. Hopefully not us to them. We don't count other people our enemy. But some people, just because you're a Christian, they are opposed to you and hostile. What did Paul teach in Romans chapter 12? Vengeance is mine, says the Lord. I will repay. And that's when you think of a passage like Isaiah 54, verse 17. You just let God work it all out. And in the life of the Jews in the days of Esther with her and Mordecai, God had the last word, didn't he? Don't try to fight back. Don't try to get revenge on people who mistreat you. Just put it in the hands of God and let him take care of it. And if he doesn't take care of it in this life, he will in judgment, won't he? And even with our vindication, if we're not vindicated, and listen, we're not always vindicated in this life. Listen, one thing that we should know about the book of Esther, this is a beautiful story that worked out perfectly and just right. In real life, it doesn't always work out perfectly and just right. Like sometimes in this world, we don't get the vindication that we would like. But in the end, we will, because all things will work together for good. We'll get our reward in heaven if we have the right attitude. All right. Well, that's the book of Esther, and we'll move on to something else next week. I'm leaning towards John the Baptist. I think we're going to study him if I don't change my mind.